White Aryan resistance calling. White Aryan resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
Well, this is it, boys and girls. The last day, the very last day of the month, and the last day you've got to do that special thing that you promised yourself you were going to do. Tomorrow, it'll be too late. You'll have to work on another month. Terrible Tommy here. Did you miss me, boys and girls? Yeah, we ran a couple of archive shows there. And we're going to do that on Saturday and Sunday, so you'll get a show every day of the week. But two of the days, it'll most likely be an archive show. Anyhow, it is the 31st of May, 2016. And it's almost noon here in the Midwest, Eastern Standard Time, and we're ready to go. I wonder how many barf bags you guys filled up on all that stuff that was on TV the last few days. They ran it and ran it and ran it. That phony patriotism, that hypocritical crap. The kind of stuff I used to jump up and down and sing Yankee Doodle Dandy to way back in the right wing, way back there in the 60s. But I grew up. Yeah, I grew out of that when I saw the way the game was played and who was playing it and who the prime movers and shakers were. I said, what the hell is going on here? I'm out of your game, man. Deal me out, baby. Deal me out. You know that old saying, when they can spit in your face, and you think it's the dew? That's what they do in mass, not only in this country, but all over Europe. They spit and barf in your face, and you think it's the dew. Well, I know it's not the dew, and you know it's not the dew, but most of the people are just wallowing around in doo-doo. I almost get literally sick at my stomach when these holidays come around, especially these political holidays. These let's go to war. War is wonderful, but oh, it's too bad. All these guys got their brains blown out. Look at Verdun's, well, 300,000 or 400,000, and all those other places in World War I. Millions of white men fighting each other. Oh, I know the French brought a few niggers in from North Africa. But it was mostly whites killing whites. For nothing. For nothing. Well, it was for something. Somebody was getting rich off of it. Bankers, arms makers, and so forth. We'll build you a big old, big Bertha cannon that'll shoot all the way to Paris, man. But you gotta pay us a lot of money. Don't you feel like walking up to one of these super patriots with wearing stars and stripes shorts and that slogans all over them and just beat the hell out of them? Don't you feel that way? I feel more anger towards those people than I do the average Negro, to be perfectly honest. I hope you're not one of those boys or girls that run off to every right-wing racist gathering that comes along. I was just reading a rundown that an old-time friend of mine, which we totally disagree on tactics in the right wing, but still, he was a pretty good guy, even though he's delusional. He sent me his magazine about the recent white unity gathering of the Klans down in Rome, Georgia. And I want to tell you something. He did a terrific job here of identifying everybody that was there, every organization that was there, all the addresses were there, how much it cost to go there, what bar and restaurant they frequented, and on it went. So all you have to do, Mr. Dees, is take this magazine and copy out of it, and you'll have the whole ball of wax. And then you can send it on to your FBI whores, because the right wing tells you everything you want to know. There isn't anything they don't tell you. So I, oh boy, well, anyhow, I gave up on preaching about that a long time ago, because it just goes nowhere. They still keep doing the same shit they did 20 years ago or 30 years ago. One thing you got to watch out for, boys and girls, is we get farther into this campaign, this silly carnival campaign for president. It's going to get wilder and woolier, and it is already. In my limited socializing, and I do say limited, they're already starting to, everybody's becoming an expert. Everybody's either totally totally polarized on one side or polarized on the other side, and they're yelling and screaming and cussing each other and everything else. And it's going to get a lot worse. But what you got to watch out for if you socialize or hang out in places, that you don't get sucked in. It's a perfect way for infiltrators and agent provocateurs to get into a crowd of people who are having a good time, having a few drinks and like that, and get people to say things they shouldn't say. And there's going to be a lot of that. A few drinks and guys start talking about, well, we ought to, yeah. And guys say, oh, yeah? How should we do it? Well, yeah. If all of a sudden you find yourself in a hoosegow being charged with some kind of a federal crime, you don't even know what the fuck happened. So I would say the closer we get into this campaign, the deeper we get into this campaign, the better it is for you to just stay home and drink your beer and not get too much into these confabs where everybody's going to start arguing and screaming and taking positions. Because that's when loose lips sinks your ass. Don't forget I told you that, because I know it's going to happen. They even try to suck me into their big arguments about this thing. And it's a waste of time. We got nothing to gain by getting into their arguments. I did go with my gal to a street fair at a local small little town here not too far from us. And we usually go up there every year on a Sunday afternoon or Saturday afternoon. Everybody's having garage sales all around town. That's a lot of fun. But I noticed every year the complexion of the crowd gets darker. Like clockwork, every year there gets to be more mixed-race couples, more mulatto kids, and more Mexicanos. And it won't be too many years or decades until it's all brown or black. At that rate, I'll tell you that. And right in the middle of this thing, we were sitting listening to a band, good singer on the bandstand, when I saw a bunch of cops gathering around having a confab, and sure enough, a little white kid had disappeared. They didn't say white. When the gal got up to announce we're looking for a lost kid, she didn't say white. She said how tall, what color clothes he had on, and I yelled out at the top of my voice, what race was he? And the gal said white. So anyhow, they got the message. I mean, this idea of trying to identify lost kids or rapists and so forth of without identifying their skin color, their race, is ridiculous. The easiest way to identify anybody is by their race. I mean, there's a million people are a lot alike otherwise, but what color was he? Okay, he was white. I haven't heard, they must have found the kid all right, because I haven't seen anything, oh my God, stories in the newspaper. But I was just thinking, with these crowds changing very rapidly in the public, you've got to be super, super attentive to your kid. Because there's going to be a lot more, not only brown, not only black, but the white perverts out there that'll snatch your kid. And if you're one of these Christian, I love everybody people, you're going to learn the hard way that there are just certain people you just can't love. Right? Incidentally, there's a whole lot of lust going on in this country and around the world, but really very, very little love. Some of the best books I've ever read are thin books. Some of the best books, yeah. They've only been around 100 pages. It's like people. They can talk. I got an email in here from a young man over in Britain. It's some kind of a manifesto. And he wants me to read this manifesto. And I said, well, when I get time, I'll read it. But the damn thing is so wordy and so long. And so, I mean, just ridiculous. Most people can't seem to get their thoughts arranged in simple, bottom line paragraphs. They want to write on and on and on. You know, I've got some of these books on the shelf. I got one I know it's 500 pages, 500-600 pages. I'll probably never read it. I mean, you know, the only way I can read a big book like that is maybe a chapter at a time and then put it away. But these young guys are going to save the white race, and they give you a manifesto that is pseudo-intellectual, and I can barely understand it. So I'll read it, and I'll reply to him, and he's not going to like my reply. I'm going to read you something out of a new book about the last days of Stalin. I don't know for sure how accurate it is, but I'm going to give it to you. Stalin's henchmen started to jockey for position on the Kremlin's chessboard, each trying to present himself as the dictator's heir apparent. With great slyness, Khrushchev began to maneuver against Beria, Jew, and another presidium member, Malenkov, pretty sure he was a Jew too, who was featured on the cover of Time magazine in late March as the probable new Soviet chief. Time called him the Cossack with the shady past and forbidding presence who stepped from Stalin's shadow into the role of number one. But Malenkov overreached when he crudely doctored a photograph from an official reception held in 1950. When the photo appeared in Pravda a few days after Stalin's death, Malenkov had airbrushed out Andrei Gromyko, Bulganin, Anastas Mikoyan, Khrushchev, and Zhao Enlai, making it look as if he were standing alone with Stalin and Mao. Khrushchev's campaign for power was altogether more subtle. He literally caught his chief opponent Beria, a Jew, with his pants down. After Khrushchev engineered Beria's arrest during the June 1953 presidium meeting in the Kremlin, Beria's military escort took his belt and popped off the buttons on his waistband so he could have to hold up his trousers with both hands, preventing him from making a run for it. The news of Beria's downfall made the prisoners in the gulag even more ecstatic than they had been 4 months earlier when Stalin died. The author's book briefly but vividly depicts Stalin's anti-Semitic, anti-Jew project in his last days. In one crucial respect, the author alters our picture of the anti-Jewish campaign. People have long thought that in 1953, Stalin was planning to forcibly transfer Soviet Jews to Bayrobaidzhan,
the Siberian Jewish homeland developed in 1928, just as he had earlier transferred the Chechens and the Crimean Tartars, the Ingush, and other ethnic groups. Scholars have supposed that this massive deportation failed to occur only because Stalin died before he could make it happen. But the author finds no actual evidence of a plan to transfer the Jews. He argues that the anti-Jewish atmosphere was so intense in the months before Stalin's death that many simply assumed such a project was in the works. The deportation swiftly became a worldwide rumor, and within a few years would be reported in the Western press. This story, to give him, Khrushchev later said that he himself had convinced Stalin not to deport the Jews, but he seems to have invented this story to give him credibility for undoing one of Stalin's evil plots. The archives reveal no trace of any scheme for a large-scale transfer of Jews to Bayrobidzhan. One important spur for Stalin's anti-Jew phase was Golda Meir's visit to Moscow in September 48. Before 1948, Stalin was not notably anti-Semitic, although he had ordered the deaths of Kamenev, Zinoviev, and Trotsky, all of them Jewish. One of his closest advisors to the end, the thuggish Lazar Kazanovich, was a Jew. Now, this is a guy who exterminated all those people early on before World War II in Stalingrad. All the intelligentsia, all the doctors, lawyers, and all that. He was the mass killer henchman for Stalin. There's a book called The Wolf in the Kremlin. You should pick it up. Meyer then still told Golda Meyerson, that was her real name, Meyerson. She was born in Milwaukee, I believe it was the new Jewish state's diplomatic representative. When she visited Moscow's Choral Synagogue on the high holidays, thousands of Russian Jews crowded rapturously around her, an event that must have shaken Stalin. There was evidence that Soviet Jews, as Rubinstein puts it, remained Jews with longings and dreams that extended beyond the physical and spiritual borders of the Soviet state. Stalin had allowed the newly communist state of Czechoslovakia to ship arms to an embattled Haganah earlier in 1948, which was a Jewish terror squad, and so had played a major, perhaps even decisive, role in the birth of Israel. The Soviet Union was the first country in the world to recognize Israel, which Stalin viewed as a future socialist ally. But when Stalin saw the kind of devotion that Meyer had inspired, he began to turn against the Jews. Another good book on this is Stalin and the Jews. Very good book. Stalin had always been suspicious of Soviet citizens whose homelands lay outside the USSR. He had already persecuted the nations Koreans, Poles, and Greeks. With the founding of Israel, Jews too had become foreigners, and their loyalty was now suspect. Most Soviet Jews had relatives in either Israel or America, with their close ties to the outside world. To a mind like Stalin's, they were clearly a potential fifth column. Well, I could see, I can understand that. I don't think that's too hard to understand. Even before Meyer's visit, Stalin was worried about Jewish support of the emerging state of Israel. In January 1948, he ordered the murder of the Yiddish actor and director Solomon Michiels, the head of the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee created during the war. He began to eliminate Yiddish publications and theaters and started arresting Jewish cultural figures by the hundreds. 1949 saw Stalin's campaign against the rootless cosmopolitans, as he called them, Jews. He was laying the foundations of the official Soviet anti-Jewism, which would survive until the collapse of the USSR four decades later. Intellectuals with Jewish names are subject to moral lynching. Groups of students rummaging through the works of Jewish professors eavesdrop on private conversations, whisper in corners. Jews no longer receive an education, are no longer accepted at the university or the graduate study. Scientist Olga Friedenberg wrote these words in her diary in 1949. Later generations of Soviet Jews would recognize Friedenberg's description all too well. Quote, Hitler may have been insane, but Stalin certainly was not. This is why the world Stalin built survived his death, whereas Hitler's did not. On January 13, 1953, TASS, the Soviet news agency, dropped a bombshell. They announced that in Pravda that a terrorist group of doctors had been killing important public figures by sabotaging their medical treatment. Nine doctors had confessed. Six of them were Jewish. Pravda accused the doctors of being in cahoots with an international Jewish bourgeois nationalist organization, the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, and with the Jewish bourgeoisie nationalist Mikuls. A month later, a harassment campaign began against Russian Jews, ending only with Stalin's death. Gangs of schoolchildren hounded their Jewish classmates. Irate citizens demanded that Jews be fired from their jobs, expelled from Moscow, and punished for their supposed avoidance of the front during World War II. In fact, Jews had served in disproportionately large numbers on the front lines, but mere facts carried no weight with such a popular expression of Jew hatred. Traditional Russian and anti-Judaism vastly accelerated the momentum of the doctor's plot. It was like hell in the hospitals, wrote the regime's propagandist Ilya Ehrenberg in his memoirs. Patients refused to take medicine from Jewish doctors, afraid they would be poisoned. The New York Times treated the doctor's plot as an obvious falsehood. Stalin was taking one more leaf out of Hitler's book, a Times editorial asserted. But the Times, in another article, also suggested that there actually have been some kind of conspiracy and the Kremlin may have gotten wind of it. In the case of Stalin's 1937 massacre of 30,000 Red Army officers accused of working for Germany, and they may have. Times readers were reminded to see that the high command and the upper echelon of the Russian military were cooperating greatly with the Germans' military up until the war. And so, in fact, that's where a lot of the people who went against Hitler came from, was that their friendship with the Russian, thousands of these Russian officers. Times readers were reminded that the charges may have had some basis in fact. This was a dangerous equivocation. The Times was given credence, even if limited, to Stalinist conspiracy theory. Meanwhile, Western Communist parties predicted and towed the line, taking Stalin's side against the doctors. The most intriguing part of the last days of Stalin deals with the aftermath of Stalin's death. Within a few weeks, the Kremlin took a stunning peace offensive, proposing a new round of talks to end the Korean War. Malenkov proclaimed in a speech the Soviet Union's policy of prolonged coexistence with peaceful competition of two different systems, capitalist and socialist. The Soviets made a conciliatory move in Germany and at the United Nations. The doctor's plot, the Kremlin announced to widespread public confusion, was an error. There had been no such conspiracy. Mikuls was rehabilitated, and a million prisoners were released from the gulag. Ehrenberg, on May Day 1953, wrote that now is the time for dialogue, for a truce in a Cold War. As far as Stalin offering to the Jews the country of Birobidzhan, it was way out in East Soviet Union, and I don't think there was much going on there, but very few Jews accepted that gift. some did, and there was some Jewish population there up until, I think, World War II. I think I read something where the last synagogue that was there closed up. So anyhow, the Jews, they wanted the center of the universe, Israel. They didn't want to be out back, man, which makes to me look very stupid, because if the Jews would have accepted the deal and got transported clear out there to Eastern Soviet Union, they would have been pretty much protected, except they're very close to the Asian nations out there. And if so many Jews died in World War II, there probably wouldn't have been hardly any died at all if they'd have taken them up and moved out there. But that wasn't the plan. They did not want to be Eastern Soviet Union hillbillies. They wanted to be right in the main part of the mix of what was going on, even if they had to lose a few thousand. But I do recommend you pick up that book, Stalin and the Jews. It's very, very revealing. You can pick it up for a couple of bucks at a used bookstore, or even wholesale books on the Internet. If the right-wingers would start reading different books than they always read, they'd be a lot better off. They just want to read these books about the glorious Uncle Adolf. And one more comment. As Stephen Kotkin has shown in his superb recent biography, Stalin thrived because his personality fit perfectly with the paranoid mindset of Bolshevism. The Bolsheviks tried to overthrow foreign governments, and so the rest of the world did not trust them. To Lenin, this meant that the world was trying to overthrow Bolshevism. Stalin institutionalized Lenin's paranoia and made it a basic tool of the state. Well, I think all governments do that to a degree. Stalin, a lifelong bookworm, had carefully studied Machiavelli's The Prince. But he far outstripped Machiavelli in his championing of fear as the primary instrument of statecraft. Well, we've got it in this country, I'll tell you that. In the end, fear would devour its practitioners, making everyone its victim, including even the leader of all nations, master of all science, father of the Soviet people, and the great beloved Stalin. Well, I submit to you that this fear thing is used in the West much more intelligently. They know how to do it in a way that many people do not think it's going on. This whole country's running on a fear level. And Trump is using it in his campaign. Yeah, we're going to make America great again. And fear these people, fear China, fear everybody else. We don't have to fear China and these people. We just have to have a policy that works out best for both countries. I think there's no problem with dealing with the Chinese or almost any other government, as long as people negotiate and negotiate in good faith. When you don't negotiate in good faith, that's what brings on wars. Well, Sammy, what are you doing this summer? Well, I'm going to the lakes, and I may climb a mountain or two. Fred, what are you doing? Well, I'm going to go maybe to the beach and maybe to Disney World and like that. Well, wait a minute. Jaime, where are you going? Well, I'm bicycling to Auschwitz-Birkenau. Ride for the Living, an annual fundraising event during which participants cycle from Auschwitz-Birkenau to Krakow, JCC, is a celebration of Poland's Jewish history. So to celebrate to have a holiday and celebrate things, we're going to have all these people ride their bicycles down to the death camps, alleged death camps. Do you see something strange in this? Do you see some type of something a psychiatrist could really get his mind around? I mean, you know, we saw people turning out to give memorial to troops in the army and French and German Americans that died in mass, which I think was commercialized way too much. But on the other hand, what is this making a religion out of death? The death cult of the Jews. Now, everybody does it somewhat, but the Jews make a real program out of it. And I see it as being really sick myself, but I'm sure others will disagree. Sort of like, let's bicycle down to Bull Run. Let's bicycle down to Antietam, have a party and get drunk. Wow. I don't know. Seems a little strange to me. I've got a picture here. I'll send it out to you. Shows, I don't know, 100 or so Jews, all with the same T-shirt on their bicycles, standing out front of Birkenau and Auschwitz. I don't know, man. Back in the day, I and my friends used to tumble around a few times with Irv Rubin, head of the JDL in Los Angeles. It got to be quite a dog and pony show. If you ever get into the main train station in downtown L.A., if you go back to about where their little restaurant area is, you'll right on that spot is where we had a major riot back in the day and sent the JDL scampering for their lives. Her Reuben was running for his life for blocks. I had one of my men was chasing him, but he never could catch him. They had set up a trap for us. We were L.A. court, and when we come out, some of us were going to get on the trains to go home, including myself. And they chose to attack us there in the train station. They even had the Valley newspaper there to take pictures of their glorious victory. But it didn't turn out to be very victorious. Several of the JDL guys were beaten and bloody. One ended up in the hospital for quite some time, I understand. And my old buddy Carl Strait chased him around with a cigarette ashtray, one of these kind to sit up in about 3 or 4 feet. Anyhow, it was quite a thing. But anyhow, it reminded me because Kahani's grandson, the Israeli government's been holding him, evidently. They don't like what he's talking about. And, of course, Kahani, the old man, was assassinated over on the East Coast, they say by Arabs, and maybe it was Arabs, but I think it was the Israeli government itself and the intelligence people that knocked off Kahani, and his son, they killed him too, as far as I'm concerned, and now his grandson is getting the heat. So, I mean, you got to... It takes more than being just a Jew. You got to be the right kind of Jew or they'll do you in, man. Irv Rubin was obviously assassinated in the L.A. I think it was the L.A. County Jail. No, it was in the federal lockup in L.A. He was going to be going to prison for quite some time due to his exploits. But he took a dive off the second tier or third tier of the federal jail, dove into the concrete and died. That wasn't the way Irv Rubin was. He may have been an opponent, may have been an enemy, but he wasn't a coward. And so as far as I'm concerned, the powers that be or the Jews themselves set it up and the blacks did the job. His wife feels it was assassination too, and she's tried to push it, but got nowhere. So anyhow, that's the way it works. The only thing that Irv Rubin and his boys ever did that was suicidal is
to attack I and my men in the street. He never did too well at that. Well, I guess you can attack homosexuals in West Virginia and not be a hate crime. As a judge rules, those charges against Stuart Butler may sound like a textbook hate crime case, but a year later, the former running back no longer faces charges. In April 2015, police say, a Marshall University football player saw two men kissing on a West Virginia street, hopped out of the passenger seat of a car shouting homophobic slurs, and attacked the men, punching them in the face. Those charges against Stuart Butler may sound like a textbook hate crime case, but a year later, the former running back no longer faces charges of violating the men's civil rights. Yeah. That's partly because West Virginia, like 19 other states, does not have a hate crime law that protects people targeted specifically because of their sexual orientation, according to the Human Rights Campaign. And while the U.S. Justice Department is still weighing its options in the case, some observers say it may not fit the federal definition of a hate crime, if only for technical reasons. Now, you see, this guy's a star football player on a university team. You know how that works. All kinds of black players have raped and killed people and everything else and gotten off. Look at O.J. Simpson. Yeah. They love sports. These white guys love sports more than anything else. Don't mess with our stars, okay? Well, I'd pack my things and move to West Virginia right now so I could beat up on gays. Just kidding. But I don't have to, because Indiana, I think, doesn't have a hate crimes law yet. Yet. Don't worry, they'll get it sooner or later. Now, as far as I'm concerned on something like that, two guys kissing, I would be rolling in the aisles laughing out the window of a car. I'd be laughing so hard I couldn't have beat up on them. However, when I see that happening in a movie, I sort of go, yuck, yeah. It's just not something that I like to see. That's not pleasant to look at. In a decision this month, Cable County Circuit Court Judge Paul Farrell said West Virginia civil rights laws protects people based on sex, but not sexual orientation. Wait a minute. Orientation. Oh, you mean vertical or horizontal? And ruled to drop the hate crime charges against Butler so he could go back and play football in 60 days, giving the prosecutor time to appeal. Well, you know what's going to happen. Probably the feds will come down on them. Many other states specifically mention sexual orientation. You can't be lay in certain directions. I mean, you know, you got vertical, horizontal, and all that kind of stuff. Enlisting the categories that elevate violence or threats of violence to a hate crime, West Virginia lawmakers had plenty of chances to follow suit, but didn't do it, Farrell said. The ruling leaves two opinions for the West Virginia prosecutors. Boy, they spent a lot of money on this crap. You realize how much money it costs to prosecute this stuff? Hope for a favorable upcoming appeal with the state Supreme Court. Now, there you go, another layer. Thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars are going to be spent that they could use to build schools with. If they lose the lobby for changes to state law with a legislature that typically hasn't added LGBT protections. Well, instead of costing the taxpayers so goddamn much money, why don't we just say if somebody's caught beating the hell out of somebody like that, he becomes a contract to the person, has to work for the guy for a year, and follow him around to all the gay clubs. That would be punishment more than what they could give them at court, because they'll probably get a suspended sentence or something. But what do you think about that? If a guy commits is stupid enough to commit a hate crime in broad daylight, then he should be forced to be a contract to the guy he beat up and be forced to live around him for a year and go out with him to all the homosexual clubs. and sit through it. I think that would sort of cure that shit. Would for me, I'll tell you. Well, for now, I guess the two homosexual boys can go back to kissing, and the attacker can go back to playing football until we get this all ironed out after spending $1 million on it. Well, my, it turns out that guy was a black guy that beat up on those poor homosexuals. Stuart Butler. Well, he's a star football player. We can't have him in jail, man. We'd lose thousands. Now here goes another $1 million. When Mississippi Governor General Jim Wood announced his state will not join 11 others in the federal lawsuit against the Obama administration over its directive of transgender bathrooms that left Governor Phil Bryant in a bit of a conundrum, and he isn't alone. The governor has opted to join Texas in its broad lawsuit against the federal government in his capacity as governor alone, said Hood in a statement Thursday afternoon. I want to tell you, boys and girls, this is all politics, 100% politics. These phony bastards, they're going to make a lot of hay, get a lot of press, and maybe get up another notch on the pole. But it's going to go through. Sooner or later, they're going to push this shit through because. And you're going to have transgender bathrooms. I ran into one in, where was it? Chicago or Fort Wayne when I was flying around someplace. And I looked at that thing and I said, what the hell? Okay, only the Attorney General can represent our state in such lawsuits, which includes all branches of government, and more important, all the people of our state. Why can't they just rise up also and say, we don't want no more wars, we don't want to send more guys over there to get killed in the Middle East, that's more important than crappers, right? The memory of his loss in 2015, said Hood, hadn't faded, and he said he was opting out to avoid a repeat of that experience. Yeah. Last year, the Office of Attorney General joined a lawsuit in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to stop the Department of Justice from interfering with the way in which local schools operate their restrooms. Well, that's a no-brainer. It should be a no-brainer. Local school districts should run their bathrooms the way they choose see fit. And if the people don't like the way they're running it, then toss them out, the school boards and the president and the heads of the schools and everything else. That should be a state or local level deal. And I ain't going to stick around here while we have all these multiple toilet things, man. I'm going to move to West Virginia or someplace. They ain't going to make me go in there and, well, you know what you're going to see if you go in there, man. Wait a minute. That's why I've never understood the way they build urinals. They build them around like their little teeny closet where you can hide your little teeny penis in it. What are people so embarrassed about their penis? What's the matter with men that they're so embarrassed about their penis? I mean, you know, come on, give me a break. In fact, a whole lot of men will never go to a urinal. They'll go inside the locked door cabinet there before they'll pull out their pee-pee. One thing I like about the country out here, you know, sometimes I just got to go and I can't get to the house in time. I can open the door on the garage and take a leak right out the door and they can kiss my ass if they don't like it. But they have to have good eyes, because the closest people would be about half mile away. And believe me, they ain't going to see it. Point is, they will spend millions of dollars in these cases like this. Millions of dollars that should go to schools, classrooms, fixing the highways, fixing the dirty water, and all that kind of environmental problems, all that kind of stuff. But they will spend millions on this kind of stuff because it's something that tickles the ears, number one, of these crazy-ass Christians. I mean, you get south of the Mason-Dixon land, and you'd know it right away when they get into this stuff. But they could solve it on the local level. They don't need the federal people. And if the federal government wants to go to war over urinals, bring it on. Bring it on. We'll have a civil war over pee-pee pots. Now, I heard a little show from Max Kaiser over there in Britain, who's an American actually living in Britain, that I thought you should hear. I recorded it, and I want to play it back for you. He's a funny guy, but I call him Crazy Max, but he puts out some good stuff. So here you go, man.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. It's hard to believe today, but there was once a time when a British prime minister might say something like, "We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." End quote. Well, now, apparently, the price is right for surrender. Whatever the cost may be. Stacey?
I'm sure many Brits will love that Churchillian quote in an American accent. It's quite good.
Was Churchill?
Yeah.
I thought it was the guy who sold insurance on TV.
He was quite American, half American anyway. Well, America has come to the UK, American ideology and policy in terms of fracking. North Yorkshire Council fracking decision, a declaration of war. Anti-fracking campaigners have accused North Yorkshire Council of declaring war on people's rights to clean air and water after it approved the first operation to frack for shale gas in 5 years. Now, notice that they call them anti-fracking campaigners rather than just people living there who don't want their water and air polluted and all the we've already covered this, that never-ending number of lorries that have to come in to bring in water to frack and also all the equipment. Now, the name of the town is very British. Where they're building this, where they've approved this well to be fracked. Kirby Misperton.
Kirby Misperton. Kirby Misperton. Crispy Merbinbin.
And the well is known as KM8, or in internet language, I guess that would be okay, mate.
Right. Well, we knew that the fracking was going to happen regardless of what anybody said, the population, you know, that we live in the age of impunity. There's an agenda to extract wealth, and anyone who gets in the way is exterminated. So, you know, we're all Palestinians to that extent, and the people in this town, Pika-Pika-Tika, wherever it is, in freaking northern, somewhere north, they're the Gaza of Britain. They're just going to get rolled over by the bulldozers. Nobody cares. They have no rights. They have no agency. Fracking itself has been proven to be completely uneconomic. It just creates huge loads of debt that never get paid back. Then the frackers disappear, having taken their fees, and they leave you with the ecological devastation.
Yes, well, in terms of, you know, they claim to be kind of democratic. They said, well, we're going to let the people speak. We want to hear what you think about bringing fracking to this community. It's going to bring jobs. They always say jobs. That's the thing that they try to buy people off with. Well, it turns out that they did receive representations, as they call them, and there were 4,375 people who said they were against it, and 36 in the community who were for it. So the government looked at it and said, well, those 36 people have a good point, and we're going to go with them. Now, the government has said it is going all out for shale. That's the quote from them, and that's going to come into play later when we talk about Hillary Clinton and how she came over as Secretary of State to force Europe to adopt shale. But I want to look at the fact that, you know, people who are against fracking point out that, you know, you can look to America and see they've had fracking for 8 years now, or 10 years, and you can see what it's actually caused, and it's caused water contamination, earthquakes, noise and traffic pollution, and we've seen that over and over. Now, in the U.S., there are very, very few regulations against any of the water contamination. For example, we have the Clean Water Act in America, but frackers are exempt from that. Here, they're not going to be exempt from those sort of things, and even in America with no environmental regulations on frackers, it's been unprofitable. Here, they are going to have to abide by environmental regulations, which means it's going to be even less profitable.
Well, they don't need to make a profit to generate fees.
Yes.
Just like in the City of London. Those banks don't need to make profits to generate fees. Hedge fund managers don't need to make profits to generate fees. Politicians don't need to deliver to generate bribes. That we live in the age of impunity, that we've got an entrenched oligarch class of kleptocrats who just steal all day long, and if anyone gets in their way, they are marginalized, kicked off the grid, or killed.
So in North Yorkshire, you have about 125 people per square kilometer. Now I'm going to compare it to Wyoming, where you have about 4 people per square kilometer. So a tiny, tiny fraction of the percentage of what North Yorkshire has. Here is a headline from just 2 or 3 weeks ago, and this is, fracking can contaminate drinking water. It took nearly a decade, but former Environmental Protection Agency scientist Dominic DiGiulio has proved that fracking has polluted groundwater in Wyoming. So 8 years ago, people in Pavilion, Wyoming, living in the middle of a natural gas basin, complained of a bad taste and smell in their drinking water. U.S. EPA launched an inquiry, helmed by DiGiulio, and preliminary testing suggested that the groundwater contained toxic chemicals. Then, in 2013, the agency suddenly transferred the investigation to state regulators without publishing a final report. So this guy left the EPA, and now he's releasing the information that their water is poisoned, but the EPA, the government regulator, refuses to let the people know themselves. They did not release this information. They did the study. They didn't release the information. And this is a sort of, maybe America's more extreme in terms of what will be tolerated here, but probably not.
You know, every few years the government launches a campaign to try to establish what are British values.
Oh, I have.
You know, every few years, just what are British values? Well, there are no British values other than to allow foreign frackers to come in and destroy your country. I mean, that's a value, I suppose, but it's nothing to be proud of, I wouldn't think. But, you know, replace the Union Jack with fracking rigs, you know, frack under the Buckingham Palace. I'm sure there's plenty of gas underneath there.
In fact, in Oklahoma is the next place we're going to go where there has been a lot of fracking, and they were allowed to frack under the state capitol. So that's how pro-fracking they are in
House
Oklahoma.
House of Parliament, frack under there. It's a useless organization run by nincompoops. Plenty of gas underneath there.
Now, remember, North Yorkshire has 125 people per square kilometer. Oklahoma has about 35. So, again, a fraction of the population density that North Yorkshire has. Oklahoma takes action on fracking-related earthquakes. But it's too late, critics say. So more than 5 years after Oklahoma first experienced a startling increase in earthquakes linked to the disposal of huge volumes of wastewater created by hydraulic fracturing for oil, the state continues to shake, and the number of strong quakes is increasing. In 2009, there were 20 quakes of magnitude 3 or higher, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Last year, there were 890. In 2009, no quake measured 4.0 or greater. Last year, 30 did. So here's a map of Oklahoma. All those orange dots, all the dots are earthquakes. All the orange dots are bigger than 3.0, and those ones are the mega ones over 4.0. And up to 5.1 they had just a few weeks ago, and that was felt across 7 neighboring states.
Well, look, fracking will create jobs, but not as they're being described by the government. They're going to create jobs for palliative care and cancer wards and hospices for the dying from people who get cancer from the fracking. There's your jobs. But
well,
it's not going to create anything meaningful. And
there were a lot of high-paying jobs in America. They're averaged about $100,000 workers, so maybe 65,000, 70,000 pounds that the salaries were in the fracking fields across America. Now, however, the cost, in Wyoming, you have huge swathes of the landscape with abandoned wells, and the companies go bankrupt, and they say, we don't have the money to
clean it up. Right, you get a high-paying job for a couple of years. The fracking well extinguishes itself very quickly. You never generate enough energy to pay off the debt. It's a money-losing proposition economically. I mean, there's a lot of jobs for prostitutes. I mean, all those English lasses can go up north and, put out a shingle and show some thigh, baby. You get a job.
Now, again, in Oklahoma, now, a lot of the people are very upset because if you've ever lived through an earthquake, a 5.1 is pretty big and it is pretty terrifying. And these are happening nonstop all through the night and people can't sleep. So, however, the Republican-controlled legislature passed legislation last year that prevents local governments from ordering moratoriums on wastewater injections into the ground. So it's the water injection. You have to get rid of the wastewater. There's a huge quantity. There's 1.8 billion tons of wastewater were created, or gallons were created last year in Oklahoma alone, and they have to do something with it. So they inject it into the ground, and that's causing the fractures that were already there in the crust to cause earthquakes. Now, remember also in Denton, Texas, which is where fracking began, the people there voted against. They passed a law to ban fracking, and then the state government said they're not allowed to do that. They passed a new law saying that you're not allowed to have your own local choices. So here we turn to Hillary Clinton and the fact that nobody outside of the U.S. empire is, they're all like these local groups that want to ban the fracking, these, whether they're in Oklahoma or in Denton, Texas. They don't have a choice. So here, Hillary Clinton's energy initiative pressed countries to embrace fracking, new emails reveal. So when she was on the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton up in northern New York, in the New York State area outside of New York City, where people, there is a moratorium on fracking, that the people don't want fracking there. It's some of the freshest groundwater in the world. They've banned fracking for now. And she went out there and pretended that she is also against it and that the local people should always be able to decide. Well, far from challenging fossil fuel companies, her leaked emails show, the emails obtained by The Intercept show that State Department officials worked closely with private sector oil and gas companies, pressed other agencies within the Obama administration to commit federal government resources, including technical assistance for locating shale reserves and distributed agreements with partner nations pledging to help secure investments for new fracking projects. So here you see the Churchill, of course, during the World War II, we were fighting against corporatism. Here we now have a kinder, gentler face of corporatism, of the government and private sector forcing their will, forcing their way upon the population, whatever the population wants. And for Europe, Hillary Clinton and her whole State Department apparatus, on behalf of Chevron and the likes, went in and used Poland as a test case. They thought that was the weakest link and that they could get them to force fracking onto the people who did not want it.
They invaded Poland?
Yeah, essentially. It's always Poland first.
Poland, why are you always getting invaded like that? Well, remember TTIP, of course, when that passes, that means that there'll be even less recourse. And if you get in the way of the frackers, you have to pay triple the damages, according to them, their definition of. In other words, there's no money to be made, but they'll sue the government anyway to reclaim money and make money in legalities and lawsuits. But the actual economics of this business of hydraulic fracturing is a money loser from day one. It's more energy goes in than comes out. More debt comes in than can ever be paid off.
They want yield. So that's what the investors in the fracking industry in America, why that we have that disaster there, is bond investors are desperate for yield. They poured money into it. Now the whole industry has collapsed, leaving ghost towns and earthquakes everywhere.
Now why are they desperate for yield? Because central banks put an interest rate to zero to bail out the hedge funds and the bankers. Differential. Both sides of the equation are bankrupt from the get-go. All right, well.
The problem with Trump is, and these guys, they're going to make it worse. He's going to come down on the side of predatory capitalism like mad, as much or more than Hillary Clinton. So we can't escape it. We've been surrounded. We got a couple of wagons full of people here, and we're surrounded by Mongols, white Mongols. There's no way to win except revolution. I mean, I'm sorry. People say, Metzger, you're a little crazy, man. We can't have that. Well, I don't see any other way out. Maybe if we have complete collapse, something can change, but, you're not going to do it through the electoral process. And you Trumpites out there, let me tell you something. Gore won by 500,000 votes in popular vote, but he got screwed by the courts and, of course, by the Electoral College. And that's, even if Trump were the greatest thing since ice cream or whatever, they stop him at the Electoral College. It's very simple to do. That's what it's set up for. If the popular vote gets out of hand and gets somebody that they don't want, they simply eliminate him by the Electoral College. And that's it. That's what's going to happen. I'm sure. I'm never totally sure, but it's my opinion that if he gets through the convention and wins against Hillary, which I doubt, then they'll stop him at the Electoral College. And that's it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back tomorrow on Tuesday, and we'll see if we can dig up some more real trash, man. You need to know what's going on in that fracking stuff, man. That just proves to you that no matter how much you vote against something that's destroying your country and your land and your farmland and everything else, the state or the federal government will come in and slap you down. And that's what's led to a lot of wars and revolutions and civil wars in the past. Who knows what's going to happen here? 14-5. And watch it. They're going to be all over the place looking for somebody to talk too much and make crazy talk and so they can get you.